Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Art lovers, if you're anywhere near Rutland County this weekend, you're in luck. And if you're not in that area, well, maybe you better recheck your weekend itinerary. This Saturday and Sunday, the Chaffee Art Center is hosting its 60th annual Art in the Park Summer Festival. We're going to learn all about Art in the Park, the Chaffee, and the other things they've got going on there. Here to tell us about it is Sherry Berkheimer-Rooker, the executive director of the Chaffee. Sherry, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. Beautiful greeting. Listeners, if you want to ask Sherry about the Chaffee or Art in the Park, you can call us 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Sherry, what is the Chaffee?
The Chaffee is a wonderful place to visit, a place to take classes, camps, workshops. So we're located on South Main Street in Rutland, right across from the Main Street Park. And that's the park that we have Art in the Park in. We've had it there for 60 years. So it's really a very big connection between us and the park. So the building, I know we talked about this beforehand, so I have to be really quick, because I have so many things to talk about this morning. But just tell you a little bit. So,
please.
This building was built in the 1890s, and it's a Queen Anne Victorian mansion. It was built by George Thorall Chaffee, who also built the Paramount other places here in Rutland. And they called it Sunny Gables, so it's definitely fits its name. It's got beautiful windows, Syrian archways. You know, it's just gorgeous. So people should come for that, the art of the building. And then we also have exhibits going on. Every 6 weeks we change them. And, you can see the beauty of the artwork that we have in here as well.
Well, you know, I do want to get to the present, but I love hearing about history of the Chaffee. And I have to hear the story of Harry Houdini at the Chaffee. I hope he didn't make a painting disappear while he was there.
I know. I think about that when I'm upstairs coming down this grand staircase. So as I said, George built this, and he built the Paramount, which was called the Rutland Playhouse. So all the famous, people would perform there, and one of them was Harry Houdini. And he actually had been here for dinner when he was performing in Rutland. So I can only imagine how many other famous people were here during that time.
Mm. Wow, that's exciting to think about. We're talking with Sherry Berkheimer-Rooker, the executive director of the Chaffee Art Center in Rutland, and we're going to get to the present now. Tell us about the current exhibit you have at the Chaffee.
So right now it's called Reflecting on the Past and Future. So it's... we have a photographer here from local paper. I don't know how many things I should plug.
go right ahead. We've got time.
So actually, it's John Olander from the Rutland Herald, and he has some of his wonderful photographs. Like one is of downtown Rutland during the pandemic, and there's other beautiful ones and different feelings, different places and time. And then we have Jen Rondinoni, who has two galleries, and she's an artist that tells her story of an abusive relationship, marriage, and through her paintings. And they're really, people that read them are so impacted by, how she went through things and she's kind of healed through the art. And then we also have juried member artwork that's in our gallery shop, which is like a gift shop, and all through the mansion. And then there's a couple of rooms upstairs that we leave so that you feel like you step back into the 1890s. Mm. The one is a master bathroom. It is just gorgeous. And then there's, we call it the history room, but it was her sitting room, Mrs. Chaffee's sitting room. and it has linens from the 1800s that have been given to us for the families. And so that's kind of what you will see when you come.
There are a couple pieces in the present exhibit. One photograph, it's called something like Silent Rutland or Quiet Downtown Rutland. That is, it looks like it's taken during the day, probably during the pandemic, and it just feels so. You see beautiful Rutland downtown, but no cars, no people. It really is a pretty stark reminder of what we've been through. And the other artist has a sculpture called Phoenix that is so stunning. If I win the lottery, I'm writing you a check immediately for that piece. But tell people about Phoenix.
So Phoenix is a stained glass piece, and it has all of these kind of petal-shaped pieces, and I'm trying to think if there's maybe five or six of them. I could walk out there, but I don't want
to. That's all right. But, stay with me.
and when you light it up, you know, the whole thing, it's like the way she's the lighting, it goes from the bottom to the top, so it's a mellow to brighter, and it's all these colors, golds and reds. It's absolutely beautiful.
It is stunning and well worth so many reasons to head to the Chaffee, but that is a beautiful piece to see in person. What do you try to present in the exhibits that you show at the Art Center?
So we do different themes, I guess, if you will. So the next one we have coming in September is it's an Audubon Nature Revealed. So it's going to be, you know, those beautiful nature-themed sculptures and paintings and photographs and all of that. And then we're also going to have a solo gallery of this artist member who does raccoon pottery. And it's a bird series that he has. I think it's either 19 or 21 pieces of all different types of birds. And I don't know if you know about, like, he does this Duchiana raku, and it's, you know, so he doesn't burn in a kiln inside. It's done outside, with leaves and the technique, you know, when I'm trying to think of how to describe it. So when you do it in the leaves, it leaves kind of blackened parts, and then the part that he has designated to be color isn't touched because I think it's a wax that he puts on that. I'm trying to remember one time he did a talk on it.
I'm intrigued.
It was so interesting. And he's been doing it, you know, for a long time. He was many years ago, he was a pottery teacher at the high school. His name's Steve Halpert. So, and then after that, it follows with our holiday, all member show because of that. You know, it'll be the holidays, and we'll have a gingerbread contest, and it's really, really fun to come and see all the gingerbread that people make.
How exciting. All right, we've been to the distant past, to the Chaffee, to the present. let's get to the near future, Saturday and Sunday, the 60th annual Art in the Park Summer Festival. What takes place at the festival?
So right now, today, this morning, I'm going to be going out to lay out booth spaces. Tomorrow, people will start setting up, and it'll be like a little village in Main Street Park going up with all the tents. Saturday morning at 10 o'clock, we open, and there'll be people greeting you at the gates. We hope people give donations as part of this is one of our biggest fundraisers. We do this twice a year. We're a non-endowed art center, and, you know, we kind of do all kinds of things to bring money in the door and support the community with all of the arts as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there's live music all day. There's kids activities. Wonderfeet here, the museum here, they do kids activities. And we're also going to be doing...
Sherry, you still with us? Oh, all right, go ahead.
What'd you say?
We lost you for about 10 seconds there,
sorry.
So it's all right.
Okay, so did you hear the Wonderfeet kids activity?
That we got.
Okay, and then we're also going to have a bench that kids are going to be able to put their handprints on. And this is going to be permanently placed at Community Health Pediatrics here in Rutland. And it's part of this Rutland Bench Art Community Street Art Project we're doing. So there will be 42 benches that are going to be placed downtown and, you know, surrounding areas. And it's going to be a really fun project, and it's going to the reason we did this was, one, we all need something beautiful to look at.
Mm-hmm.
We need something inspiring for our streetscapes. And those of us that live here, those of us visiting, you know, those of us that, you know, people that might want to move here, people that might want to bring their businesses here to Rutland and Vermont. And we're also going to have a walking tour brochure that will, many years ago they did this, and you can take your brochure and walk to all these historic buildings. Like the Chaffee's one of them. And in it will be the murals, the sculpture trail that we have here. The, you know, we had a heart project in 2012. It was a street art project. The ones that are left here. There's a train project before that. All the benches. The Rutland Garden Club's beautiful garden. You know, things that you can explore when you're here, because there's a lot here.
Yeah.
I think it's just that we don't always remember.
Oh, I love that idea. Let's finish up a little bit here, Sherry, on the art in the park. How many exhibitors and what kind of variety will people be around Saturday and Sunday?
Okay, so we have, I think we have about 55 right now, and we may get a few more. That does happen.
Wow.
So there's fine art. Yeah, compared to last year, we had 23, so we're very happy. So we have fine art, of course, all different types of fine art, you know, pastels, watercolors, you know, oils and that kind of thing. We have photography, clay, all kinds of pottery, let's see, fiber items, scarves and, you know, hats and pillows and things like that. And we have wood. So there's ornaments. I'm thinking through my list.
Well, Sherry, one thing I'm always very concerned about is what kind of food will be there.
Why did I know you were there? Oh, gosh. So there will be a lot of different types of food. So let's see how hungry you are this morning. There's a food truck that does this. All these fried chicken wraps and sandwiches, like all different flavors, like hot and barbecue and that kind of thing. And they do like a waffle fry with that, but they have fried green beans. They have a funky slaw. They do a sweet potato and white bean burger. There's also going to be someone that does you know, whole food, you know, organic and things like that. So that'll be, you know, there's different things for everyone. And then so this, you know, again, wraps, sandwiches, salads, smoothies, cold drinks. They do these awesome smoothies.
Nice.
Usually there's fresh bread.
Yep.
In the fall, we do soups and stuff. But it's going to be a little warm for that. Well, I think it's supposed to be a little bit cooler, right? This weekend.
That's right. We're gonna get you some nice weather for this weekend.
You.
What are the times for Saturday and Sunday?
Dice and kettle corn. Don't forget.
Oh, yeah. There we go. Now
okay.
I'm in.
So the time, 10 to 6 on Saturday and 10 to 4 on Sunday.
All right, 10 to 6, 10 to 4, Saturday and Sunday. Now, you've had a robust schedule of camps and classes this summer. Tell us about some of them.
So, currently we have a clay camp going on. We're doing that two sessions of that. So, young people, this is about I don't know if everybody heard about the Summer Matters After School grant that many of us, we're fortunate enough to get. So it allows us to do more camps and classes for youth, kids and teens, at a lesser price, you know, so that, or even free if we can sling it with the grant. So
nice.
We're going to be doing next week a drawing with color camp. And it's, you know, an afternoon camp. We do a lot of afternoon camps and morning camps, like 3 hours, and then people can put them together for a full day if they want to. We did a metal camp. That was really fun to see what they were all creating. They were using plasma cutters and all these different things. There'll be a puppet and theater camp. So all kinds of things. Yoga.
Oh, all right. Now, I do want to talk about something that I really wasn't aware that the Chaffee offered. First of all, music lessons.
Yes, yes. Thank you for mentioning that. Yes,
sure.
We have a company called Green Mountain Music, and they work with us here and do music lessons out of the Chaffee. So it's anything string and beginner piano. So they do, you know, violin, cello, viola, guitar, ukulele, banjo, mandolin, you know, like all the, and it's wonderful because I get to hear them all day long. And, you know, they do a lot of them on the porch, especially, you know, with the way things are with children and stuff. Because they do all ages, but they can do a lot on the porch because we have a beautiful porch. It's, you know, most of it's covered, or they'll be on the side lawn. It's really beautiful to come and listen to the violin and, yeah.
I love it. And tell us about the musical instrument lending library.
Okay, so as part of the Summer Matters grant, we are going to, we've bought most of the instruments. So we've bought like 10 ukuleles, 5 guitars, you know, a few violins. There's going to be I think we bought a viola, cello. So we want to have a string trio. So people will be able to, like you do it at a library, they'll be able to check out a musical instrument before they, you know, buy one, because sometimes you're not really sure what you might like. And then we also are going to have a media lab as part of the grant that we currently have a 3D printer that was donated. Mm. So we're going to be, we just have to purchase now. We've got it all laid out, but we're going to have a media lab for teens and youth, as well as other people to be able to use here at the mansion. So that'll be something that's going to be really fun and I think useful.
Oh, man. I love hearing how you've kind of expanded what the Chaffee is doing. It really is neat as part of your mission. But you've kind of been alluding and talking about this throughout. The Chaffee is such a beautiful space. So can people rent it for events?
Yeah, you are good. You're so good at reminding me all these wonderful things I need to talk about. Thank you. Yes.
That's my job.
You can have, you know, functions here. Some people have meetings here. Some people can have, you know, have had weddings here. I haven't had a really big wedding, and that's what I really want.
Mm. I'll work on that.
Okay, thank you. Because one of my things I do is, or have done for a very long time, is plan events, hence Art in the Park. This is my 37th Art in the Park.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
And no, I'm not that old. We do it twice a year.
Right.
So you can rent it for, you know, rehearsals, bridal showers, just a meeting. We have a conference room, and in that conference room will be the media lab. So it'll be nice if people, you know, need to do like a really, maybe a seminar or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's wonderful. And then before I forget, I wanted to mention, because I keep forgetting as I'm talking to you, but we have an artisan market on Saturdays. When we're not having Art in the Park, it's outside on the Chaffee lawn from 10 to 2. That's the hours that we're open on Saturdays normally. So we have different artisans showcasing their work, and if people come and support them, they're all local, that would be wonderful.
Wow, that's a great program as well. So we should mention again, the 60th annual Art in the Park Summer Festival is this Saturday and Sunday, 10 to 6 Saturday, 10 to 4 Sunday. And then in October, as Sherry was mentioning, the fall Art in the Park will be coming up. So keep an eye out for that as well. You know, I talked about how beautiful this building is, how great it is for events. And I think you have guided tours that people can go on.
We do. If they maybe call ahead, because that's easier, because sometimes mm-hmm. we don't have a lot of people here. But I love giving tours, as you know from our conversation previously. I love talking about the Chaffee and telling, you know, different stories. There's some ghost stories. There's some family stories. There's, you know, just fun things about the building, like there's a cat door. The doorknob, how you tell where the family lives and where the servant quarters or the servants worked, We have a third floor that's not accessible, but there's stories about that because that's where the servants, and there was a ballroom up there. There's just a lot of things. It's really cool.
Yeah. We've got about Oh, excellent. And we've got about a minute and a half, Sherry. But you know, tell people, what does the Chaffee add to the Rutland community?
So what we're about is making a difference to the community. So we're trying to add programming that does that and make it accessible for everyone. That's like the Bench Art Project, because people will be able to see art outside. You know, we're a community art center, so we want everyone to feel comfortable coming here. We have kids run through here all the time. Some people think that, oh, you have to be close, you know, but no, you know, it's a great experience. Start when they're young, appreciating the arts.
And there will be kids activities this weekend at the Art in the Park. How is the Chaffee supported?
So we're supported by donations, by the classes that we run, sponsorships that we get. That's why we kind of have to think outside the box. If we have a 2022 calendar with our artists in it, it's beautiful, that people can take advantage of. That's a fundraiser. And, of course, the Art in the Park.
Yeah. Again, the Art in the Park, the Summer Festival, this Saturday and Sunday. They're at the park right there at the Chaffee Art Center in Rutland. It goes on 10 to 6 on Saturday, 10 to 4. I'm sorry, Saturday is 10 to 6, Sunday 10 to 4. Sherry Berkheimer-Rooker is the Executive Director of the Chaffee Art Center in Rutland. And like I said, hosting the 60th Annual Art in the Park Summer Festival Saturday and Sunday. To learn more, you can visit ChaffeeArtCenter.org. Sherry, thanks for stopping by and best of luck this weekend.
Thank you. We'll have to do this again.
Oh, we will. You know it. All right. Take care.
All right. Take care.
Bye now. We're going to get a CBS News update, and then we're going to learn about the Fisher. Yes. Love the Fisher. Coming up at 1 today on WDEV, we've got two mega music-packed hours of The Getaway with the one and only Mr. Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. When I got to Vermont, when someone mentioned Fishers, I thought it was like a non-gender specific way of referring to someone who is bait casting or fly fishing. Oh, grasshopper. But the more I learned about the Fisher, the more I loved the Fisher. Some people refer to them as Fisher Cats, and there's even a double-A baseball team in Manchester called the New Hampshire Fisher Cats. When doing a morning show years ago, every time I gave their score, it went something like this. The Portland Sea Dogs, 6. New Hampshire Fisher Cats, ooh, Fisher Cats, tss, they're vicious, 3. One thing I have learned through the years is that there are a lot of facts and a lot of myths floating around about my favorite land animal that need to be clear up. By the way, narwhals, my favorite ocean beings. Here to set us straight about fishers is Vermont Fish and Wildlife's fur bearer project leader, Kim Royer. Kim, I'm so very happy we're here. We're having you here for this discussion.
Oh, thank you for having me, Rick. I'm so glad that you like the Fisher.
Love the Fisher. Listeners, if you've got questions about Fishers or you want to share a Fisher story, give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Kim, describe a Fisher for us.
Sure. Well, Fisher are a member of the weasel family or the Mustelidae family. So they look very much like a weasel, except quite a bit bigger. They have long bodies, short legs. They're normally black or brownish in the rump and the leg and the tail portion. And then they have a gold or silver grizzled appearance on their head and back often. And maybe a male Fisher might be 3 feet long, including the tail. And the female fisher is often about half that size. They're much smaller in size than the male.
Where are they found in the state?
Well, they're pretty much, today, they're pretty much statewide. When I first started working for the state back in the 80s, we had very few fisher west of Route 7. But today I get sightings as far up as Grand Isle, which is very unusual. I would have probably said 30 years ago that we'd never have fisher up there. And I get sightings from the Taconics, and so they're pretty much all over the state now.
Do we have an idea of the fisher population in Vermont?
Well, we really only monitor the trend of the population, and we think it's a fairly stable. It increased for many years, and now it's pretty much stabilized. And so, you know, we know they're well distributed, and they're doing very well in the state.
Oh, that makes me very happy. What kind of habitat do they like for their home?
Well, you know, historically we thought of them as old growth or late successional species, an animal that was really tied to forested habitats, and they still are. I mean, that's their favorite habitat is forest with canopy cover, forest with some conifer growth, maybe even upwards of 50% conifers. But we have found that some fisher have become adapted and habituated to human environments, like suburban environments. And I wonder if it's because they figure out that food are easy pickings around houses, especially if there are outdoor cats. And I think they either access cat food or dog food that people leave outside, and or, you know, they'll prey. They are a predator, and their favorite prey species is snowshoe hare.
Mm.
And cats fit that size, and so if they're outside, they're at risk, not just from fisher, but from any predator.
Yeah, a lot of people do blame the fisher when the cat goes missing. So that is indeed something that does happen.
It's a possibility for sure. I would say an outdoor cat's at risk from fisher, bobcat, fox, coyote, avian predators. Just because when you think about the size of a cat, it, like I said, it's about the size of a snowshoe hare. Mm. And that's the ubiquitous prey species for just about every predator out there. So cats that are outside could be taken by just about any predator in Vermont.
Our numbers are 244-1777 and 877-291-8255. Talking about fishers, and Fred is joining us from Newbury. Hi, Fred.
Morning.
Morning.
Hey, this is very interesting. Let's see here. I'm trying to figure out how far back it was. I think it could have been 50 years ago, because I can remember my grandfather talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather was a great hunter. And anyways, here's what the story was he gave me. New Hampshire was having a real problem with porcupines.
Mm-hmm.
And so Pennsylvania had this animal called a fisher cat that loved porcupines, because the fisher cat would climb up the tree and go underneath the porcupine and attack it from underneath.
Yep.
That was the unique part of the fisher cat. Of course, New Hampshire had a porcupine problem. And so we, the fish and game, either bought them or made some sort of trade. And they, and my gramp said that maybe, you know, half a dozen fisher cats came up. And they were, you know, I don't know what the ratio between male and female would have been. But that was the deal on that.
Yeah, Fred, let me have Kim explain what happened to fishers here in Vermont, and then the porcupine population. And I think, Kim, I'm going to let you tell Fred and our listeners what did happen. I think they were trapped pretty heavily here, right?
Yeah, Fred, thanks for bringing that up. Actually, in a lot of New England, the forests in the 1800s were cleared as the European settlers moved up. They were cleared for agriculture, and species like the fisher that like forests were extirpated or went almost extinct in much of New England, and in particular in Vermont. And just as your grandfather said, in about the 1940s and 50s, There was actually a bounty on porcupines because they were so destructive to the regrowing forests and to infrastructure. And the Forest and Parks Department in Vermont actually decided to bring back the Fisher and try to have an animal here that would naturally predate porcupines. And so they worked with the Fish and Wildlife Department and got Fisher from Maine, from the state of Maine. They brought in actually 124 Fisher. They'd fly them in to either Lebanon or Burlington Airport, and they would get them off the airplane and take them out to mostly the Green Mountain Spine, up and down the Green Mountain Spine in the Northeast Kingdom. And over a period of, I think, about 6 years, they released those 124 Fisher into the state. And since then, they've done incredibly well. And like I said, we have a very, very stable population here now.
Oh, that makes me so happy to think that Fishers were flown in first class into BTV. That is so exciting to me. Are Fishers hunted or trapped now in Vermont?
There's a month-long trapping season, yes. They're not hunted. So it's a highly regulated season, and we actually require that the carcasses from those animals get turned in to us. And we actually do quite a bit of biological assessments on those carcasses. We can get age information from that, sex information. And then also we've done some disease studies and some rodenticide studies. So they provide a lot of good information that helps us monitor that population and make sure that it's sustainable into the future.
Trapped for their furs, Kim?
They're trapped for their furs, yes.
All right. Kim, how strong are they and how dangerous are those claws of theirs?
Well, for their size, they're quite strong. They certainly are able to kill an animal that is in equal size of theirs or even larger. And they are predators, so they act like a predator, but they're not really dangerous to people at all. And they, like I said, if your cat is outside, it might fall prey to something like a fisher. But they really are a solitary animal that spends most of its time alone in the woods. That's where they prefer to be. You're very lucky to have seen one. I see more tracks than I do fisher. Mm-hmm. They're certainly not an animal for people to be afraid of.
And cat owners, I don't mean to make light of your loss, but I do love this animal. Why are they called fisher cats? That's not the right name, correct?
Right. They're not a cat. And they're called, they think the name fisher actually comes from the fact that they resemble the European polecat back in the old days. And I think, I don't know whether it was a French term, but I guess they called the European polecat a fishette or something along those lines. So it was called, I think that's how the name started here. That's what they speculate, I guess. And I don't know whether people thought it looked like a cat, but it's definitely not a cat.
All right, good. Many people say they hear the blood-curdling screams or screeches of the fisher. Fact or fiction?
I believe that is fiction. We actually live trapped fisher to send to Connecticut and held them for a day or two in boxes, and I really never heard them make any kind of screaming sound. They'll make like these squeaking and chucking noises, but I've never heard them make a loud screeching sound. I think those screeching sounds may come from a vixen fox, possibly, or even sometimes, if you can believe it, I've had a colleague actually tape a porcupine making a screeching sound.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
As I admit it, and it's not very, journalistic of me, but fishers are my favorite land animal on the planet. As the Fur Bearer Project leader, I know you are loath to pick a favorite for fear of upsetting all the others out there, but you can tell me, are fishers in your top five, Kim?
Oh, definitely in my top five.
All right. Yes. We'll leave it at that. I won't push you any further.
Thank you. They are in my top five.
Excellent. How fast is the fisher?
gosh, I'm not even really sure. I don't really know. I mean, you know, in terms of clocking them miles per hour, I don't have an answer. But they are an animal that's very agile, can bound through the forest. That's how you often can identify a fisher track, is you will see they have a pattern often of two and two and two that can be as far apart. Their bounds can be as far apart as 4 to almost 5 feet. Mm. So they can move very quickly through the woods. They're very agile in the trees. They're like a squirrel. Their back legs kind of rotate, so they can come down a tree head first and bound off the tree. So they're an animal that's very well adapted to moving quickly through the woods.
All right, we're going to try to get to a couple phone calls. Cindy is joining us from Facetton. Hi, Cindy. Go right ahead.
Hey, hi. Yeah, I have seen, I just saw, like, maybe 2 weeks ago, a large, what I believe must have been a male, lopping. They kind of, like, haul up through the lawn because their legs are short. And then a while back I saw a mother with three, maybe there were even four of them. They were all in the ferns, and you could see their they've got really long, fluffy tails. Mm-hmm. And they were just like having a good old time, but the mother cat or the fisher, you know, the mom was right there by them, and I didn't do anything. I just watched them, and
yep.
That was a couple of years ago, and then just a couple of weeks ago, I saw this big boy lolloping through the grass on the other side of the house.
Cindy, yeah. I'm so envious of you. Let's take another call real quick. Going to go to Brian in Montpelier. Brian, go right ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
Hey, so I've seen about three or four fishers in Vermont, we're lucky to say. But, nice. You know, I might have missed it. But, Kim, I'm not sure. I was wondering if you could explain, how does a fisher go about killing a porcupine?
Great question.
You're not allowed to say very carefully.
No, I think I know, but I want Kim to tell us. Thanks, Brian.
Yeah, as far as I know, I've never seen it personally, but as far as I know, they go at the porcupine's face, and they keep attacking the face until the porcupine succumbs, and then they go in through the belly.
Yep.
And they usually will tear the belly open, eat the organs, and then just basically skin the animal from the inside out. So you know, I used to do necropsies on fisher back in when I was in school when they were first reintroduced, and you'd actually find quills in them, but they seem to be able to live with, most of them seem to be able to live with a few quills.
Nice. Do they hibernate, or are we likely to spot them all year long?
You'll spot them all year long. They're active all winter. They don't do well in deep, fluffy snow. And so if the snow gets over about 18 inches and is very fluffy, they may hole up for a few days. They may hole up during snowstorms. But as soon as you get a rain event or the snow gets packed down, they're out and about again and hunting.
I want to know, will you call me the next time you see one, Kim?
I sure, Rick. I'd be happy to. I certainly envy Cindy, who sees them quite regularly. So I have not had that experience. So good for her.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Cindy, next time you see one, call into the show, and I will walk right out of the studio. I will leave the show. I don't care where we are in the show that day. I will run to Facetton to see a whole family of fisher. Oh, gosh, that is a dream of mine. Now, Kim, this is a really important question. Does Fish and Wildlife need to know when they're spotted for data collection?
We're not tracking fisher right now because we actually have done some research. We put cameras out in cooperation with a research project that was going on for actually lynx. And we had cameras up and down the Green Mountain Forest and into the Northeast Kingdom and have been able to get detection rates on fisher through those cameras, and we hope maybe to continue to do that kind of work going forward in the future. So that's been a really effective way to collect data, and so we haven't actually used citizen sightings at this point, but maybe into the future we'll think about that.
And Kim, is there any truth to the rumor I've started that your department is about to change its name to Fisher and Wildlife?
That's a very innovative idea. I'll suggest that, Rick, and you should too.
When I become governor of the state, I'm just going to sign an executive order, and it will be Vermont Fisher and Wildlife. Kim, this has been so great. Kim Royer is Vermont Fish and Wildlife's Fur Bearer Project Leader. Kim, you've made me so very happy this morning sharing all this Fisher info. Thank you so much.
Sure, Rick. You make me happy that you like them so much.
I'm their number one fan. No, there is no ethics, no journalistic ethics this morning. I'm a Fisher fan. All right. Take care, Kim.
All right. We'll see you. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. All right. News is next. Then we'll be back for a reporter debrief with VT Digger's Grace Ellison. We're going to discuss the recent investigation of the Vermont National Guard. And it's an afternoon contest to wrap up the three-game series at Fenway against the former Devil Rays. Coverage begins at 3:10. Batter up at 4:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We're very proud of the Vermont National Guard and the men and women who serve in the Guard. We're proud of the work they do in the community, like they did during the pandemic. And they seem to accept their deployments around the world very willingly. So it always hurts when news comes out like what we're about to discuss next. We've been down this road before, and we trusted Guard leadership that this would be corrected. But alas, a new investigation found some of the same old behaviors persisting in the Guard. Here to tell us about that report is VT Digger's government accountability reporter, Grace Ellison. Grace, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you have questions about the report, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. You can share your thoughts about the report if you've heard about it. Grace, in 2018, VT Digger conducted an extensive investigation into the Vermont National Guard. What were some of the key things that were found at that time?
Yeah, so that investigation reported by Jasper Craven, who has been following the story exceptionally well over the years, really kind of overall documented unruly behavior on a number of levels. You know, Guard members violating policy, you know, taking place, you know, having secret, inappropriate rendezvous. You know, there were instances of sexual assault and those assaults not being properly managed by the Guard itself. So I would say, you know, overall, it documented a lot of troubling behavior and inconsistent policies in how to police that behavior.
It was pretty shocking at the time what Jasper did reveal. Results of the new report were just released. Who requested and who conducted this report?
Right. So I think it's important to go back to 2019, where there was a change in leadership for the Vermont National Guard. Major General Stephen Cray was deciding to step down from his position, and the legislature was going to pick a new leader for the Guard. At that time, we were kind of dealing with, as a state, this reporting that came out about, you know, documenting a lot of the issues that were happening in the Guard. And so Governor Phil Scott actually, at the time in 2019, requested that whoever was going to be the next leader of the Guard conduct a kind of top-to-bottom report. And so, of course, Adjutant General Gregory Knight came into the position. He was elected to the position by the legislature. He requested this report from the National Guard Bureau of Complex Investigations. So it wasn't necessarily mandated by the governor. Knight did this willingly, but it's also important to remember that the governor did request this in 2019.
And as Grace has mentioned, chosen by the legislature, Vermont, one of the few states that chooses their adjutant general for their National Guard, chosen by the legislature, done every 2 years. For this report, who were interviewed or surveyed for these findings?
Yeah, so the report included 70 interviews with officials, and it also included a really broad survey of 2,000 members of both the Air and Army National Guard units.
And what are the major findings that the report has revealed?
I think the overall takeaway is that the report found that the Guard is in generally sound organizational stature. The Guard is certainly not falling apart, but there are big issues in terms of the culture of the Guard, in terms of how people feel like they can rise in ranks, how they can rise in leadership, and how they feel respected by their superiors in the Guard. I think one of the biggest takeaways for me is that more than, or about 100 Guard members mentioned in their survey results, this perception of there being a good old boy network in the National Guard. And that manifests in people experiencing favoritism, both in the jobs that they're chosen for and in the discipline that they receive. More specifically, women are sometimes passed up for positions, you know, not based upon their abilities, but just based upon favoritism in the National Guard, and that was documented in the report. There's also this kind of pervasive fear that people feel like they can't speak up about transgressions that they witness in regard to their superiors. So there definitely is, you know, overall a troubling, hierarchical, intimidating culture that that the Guard that is somehow manifesting in the Guard.
What's been the reaction to the report of Adjutant General Gregory Knight?
Yeah, so I think he knew coming into the job that the Guard was having these issues, right? He knew and that he wanted to address them. That was kind of his selling point to the legislature during his election process, that he wanted to make these reforms. And so when I asked him, you know, did anything really surprise you about this report, he wasn't too shaken by it. I think he knew what was coming. He did say that he was surprised to hear that there was this kind of toxic undercurrent of leadership in the Guard. That's something that he was disappointed to hear, because that's something he really wanted to address when he came into the position. But I think he was well aware of the issues before this report came out.
Has he indicated any changes that he will make in light of this report?
Yeah, so when he was talking to media about this report, I mean, he definitely pointed to changes that the Guard has implemented even before the report was released. For example, he said that there's a new leader involved with the recruitment office, which was identified as an area in the report that needed some needed reform. The Equal Opportunity Office has been staffed up considerably more. But he said that, that the Guard is definitely going to do more to address the issues that this report documented by, you know, speaking with Guard members one-on-one and trying to identify the specifics and maybe the specific actors to, you know, cause this culture to persist.
And that culture, as you mentioned, the good old boy network, mentioned numerous times in interviews, in surveys. Are there other specific examples given in the report of this and how it manifests itself?
Yes, yeah, so that's a good question. I think the key question here is how does this manifest itself, which is a question that I feel like the Guard is going to have to try to figure out, because I think it does come from leadership, and maybe leadership not following the procedures that the Guard has in place about who should be promoted, about who, you know, does get chosen for senior positions in the National Guard, so that, you know, the systems don't just fall to favoritism. Because folks who work hard and who develop their credentials, you would think, should be the ones who are chosen. So I think it has to come down to a form of making sure that the policies are used and enforced, making sure that leaders take these policies seriously, because it does come from the leaders who are instituting what kind of culture their subordinates are experiencing in the guard.
Sexual assaults, sexual harassment, these have been concerns in the guard for a while. What did the report say about the reporting and tracking of that data?
Yeah, so first of all, the report, the investigators found that there were just great inconsistencies in the data they were collecting. They were getting different data back. The data that they were getting back was not consistently reported with to the Vermont legislature in this annual report that it receives about sexual assault in the guard. So there's just a mismanagement of how things are collected around sexual assault. There were details missing from some sexual assault reports that were made to the guard. And so there were also issues with, you know, there just not being enough resources for those who come forward with allegations of sexual assault. There weren't enough victims advocates at some point. And there was no organization of tracking how many victims advocates the National Guard actually had as they moved maybe from organization to organization. So there was no kind of procedure to even understand and make sure that there's enough resources for those who experience sexual assault in the Guard. But then there are also just inconsistencies in how leaders in the Guard treated those who experienced sexual assault. You know, there was one example in the report that really stood out to me where a female National Guard member had told her superiors, you know, I can't go to this training. My perpetrator there, my abuser is there. And leadership didn't know how to handle that. They said, as long as this guy is in good standing, you're going to have professional experiences with him, which is obviously really, really concerning and a break of policy and procedure to help sexual assault survivors. So that was definitely another big concern that was brought up in that report. Mm.
Grace, how did respondents feel about the leadership of the National Guard?
Respondents in the report, I think people felt that, you know, that they're, like I said before, things are generally sound in the Guard. People definitely think that, you know, leaders will, you know, keep sexual toxicity from persisting in the organization. But there is a feeling that some people are picked over others for a senior position just based upon who they know, right? And so I think that's kind of where this favoritism, this good old boy perception, whether it's a perception or reality, that's where it's coming from. There's a lack of procedure in the Guard around who is being picked for senior positions, who is being picked for promotions based upon who they are, based upon their merit, based upon their abilities rather than, you know, just who they know.
What is the retaliation protection plan?
So the retaliation protection plan was something that the National Guard Bureau mandated that all state National Guards implement in 2017. That did not happen for whatever reason at the Vermont National Guard. This retaliation protection plan was meant to, like in its title, make sure that Guard members feel like they can report transgressions that they view in the Guard, that they experience to their superiors without feeling like they're going to be retaliated against, which is, you know, very basic structure to ensure that people can report bad things that are happening in the system. And there is a feeling in Vermont's National Guard, maybe because that plan was never implemented for whatever reason at the Guard, that they can't do that in the National Guard. There is a fear that people can't come forward with problems to their leadership.
So how are complaints handled without this? It's kind of like a whistleblower protection. How are these complaints handled at the Vermont National Guard?
That's a good question. I mean, I think without these kind of like specific procedures in place, people were just kind of telling, you know, not necessarily a designated point person, but kind of just they were left with their chain of command, which isn't necessarily the best place to go to. You might not feel comfortable going to your boss, going up the chain of command, to tell them about problems that you're experiencing, especially if those people might be involved in the problems that you're experiencing. So there was not a lot of standardization around this and not a lot of good policy on making sure that people can feel like they can be honest.
Grace, did the report make any recommendations?
It did. It made 35 specific recommendations, and they were, a range talking about streamlining communication between offices, improving offices, specifically tasked with addressing, misconduct issues, and then also bringing the guard in line with federal and state regulations, so making sure all those rules are being followed. And so when I asked General Knight how he was going to pursue these recommendations, he's not required to make any of these recommendations. He said he's certainly not going to ignore them. But what he said is that there are certain teams in the Guard being assigned these recommendations right now, and they're coming up with action plans to address them. So I asked, again, is there going to be an update on when we're going to hear from the Guard about how they're addressing these recommendations? And he said, as things get sorted out, there's going to be a lot of short-term goals and long-term goals. And as those goals are established and as there are action plans in the work, he'll identify to the public how, these goals are being addressed moving forward.
Mm. Wow. Now, Gregory Knight, elected adjutant general in 2019, as we mentioned earlier, and again, he was re-upped in February of this past year by the legislature. So he has another year and a half in his term. So first of all, do you feel he hasn't had the time yet to correct the systemic problems in the Guard?
Well, to his credit, when we talk about systemic problems, they are intertwined with the systems that we've created, and it takes a lot of time and work to unintertwine them, right? So I think, part of this is just, he's only been in the position for one term as of right now. He's made a commitment to addressing these things. This report did take place over 2017 to 2020. So it included a time period that General Knight was not in the Guard. I think he would say these things take time and that he is committed to this. However, I think it's going to be really important moving forward that this is not our only assessment of where the Guard is at. I think it'll be really important for the state to come back in 5 years to assess, okay, did we make any progress? Do people working in the Guard feel differently? This should not be our only transparent look into how members of the Guard feel right now.
Yeah, transparency, it's a great word, Grace, that you bring up. Transparency is probably what everyone in the state, especially the legislature, is probably looking for from the Guard after this report comes out. My second part of the question I asked is, does this put Gregory Knight on high alert that he has until February 2023 to show real change in the culture of what's happening at Camp Johnson?
It could. He did make a comment during our conversation with the media where he said, I'm not going to be in this position forever. The next person who comes along is going to have to be committed to this work as well. So I don't think that he views this as something that he needs to tie in a bow before he leaves. You have to also question the feasibility of that. Like I said, making a cultural change, making systemic changes takes a long time. It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of reorientation. And so, I don't know if it's fair to say this has to be completely turned around on its head by 2023, but I think the public should certainly expect some sort of progress. And I think maybe an update before, that date would be in good order.
It seems, too, that the report is also saying that changes come from changes in leadership and hiring people who are more qualified, hiring diverse leadership might have the positive effects that we're looking for at the Vermont National Guard. Has Governor Phil Scott commented on the report?
You know, I'm not sure yet. I haven't followed up with the recent committees. I actually cover the city of Burlington for Vermont. So, or not, I'm sorry, not the committee, his press conferences that he's having weekly. So I'm not sure on that yet.
All right. And have you heard from any other elected officials who have reacted to the report?
I've not heard from elected officials yet, but I have heard from a lot of Vermonters, just Vermonters in my inbox, thanking VeeDigger for covering this, but also sharing their surprise, their disappointment that this culture is persisting in the guard right now.
Yeah, that really is telling. And I mean, from my introduction, you know, I don't think Vermonters are anti-National Guard or Air National Guard. I think Vermonters have been very supportive of the Guard. And for a report like this to come out after what we heard in 2018, this has got to be shocking. What else were you hearing from some of the emails that you received?
Just that people were shocked. I mean, I think that you're exactly right in the beginning intro that our guard members deserve a lot of credit. They've helped us specifically through a really difficult pandemic, you know, delivering vaccinations, delivering COVID tests. And I think this report should not discourage people from supporting their guard members who are working really hard to keep Vermonters safe during this time. I think we need to approach this report by looking at it as, you know, a temperature check of how our guard members feel in their professional environment, right? Like this report is an assessment of how they feel in their workplace. And if you don't feel like you can, you know, rise in the ranks in your workplace, if you don't feel like you can be protected from retaliation in your workplace, that's going to create some problems. And that's going to create a culture where a lot of guard members don't feel welcome, safe, or secure. And that's the problem that we need to address here. It's making sure that our guard members can do their best work in their professional environment.
The National Guard is funded by both the state and federal governments. A report like this is quite damning. Is there any possibility of the feds taking action or instituting orders to get this straightened out?
That's a good question. I'm not sure we're there yet in Vermont. Like I said, the report did find that the guard is in generally sound condition. I don't think there's any security issues with the way that things are going in the guard. You know, things aren't in shambles where it's not a productive, able organization. So I think if, you know, the problems were so deep that, you know, people weren't able to do their jobs, of, you know, the guard was just not functional. I mean, these are cultural problems that, if left unchecked, would absolutely lead to those kinds of problems. I don't want to diminish that whatsoever.
Yep.
But I think, you know, given the way things are right now, there's two directions that the Vermont National Guard could take. If these are left unaddressed, we might go toward that area where the guard is just unable to do its job. But if they are addressed, if they are reformed, I think we're just going to come out with a stronger National Guard unit.
Hear, hear. Grace Ellison is VeeDigger's government accountability reporter, and you can read her story on the Guard Report at VeeDigger.org. Grace, thank you so much for sharing that with us this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to return to meet the new associate director of Norwich University's Center for Global Resilience and Security. And a reminder that coming up today at 11 o'clock, we have Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. The last time we spoke to someone from Norwich University's Center for Global Resilience and Security, we were talking about testing wastewater. Now, that was in an effort to track for the presence of COVID-19 on the school's campus. But as fascinating as that was, I knew the center did much more than lifting manhole covers. With the recent announcement of a new associate director, I also knew it was time to get a more global understanding of what the Center for Global Resilience and Security is all about. So here to tell us about that is the new associate director, Dr. Caitlin Thomas. Dr. Thomas, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you so much, Rick. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. Listeners, to ask our guest a question about the work of the center, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. Caitlin, the name of the center is a mouthful. What exactly is the mission of the center?
It is. But, you know, we set out to take on a whole lot. And I think that the center's name really reflects that. So our mission at CGRS, which is the Center for Global Resilience and Security, it's really to seek out, to design and to share, creative, innovative, inclusive and sustainable solutions to build resilient and secure communities. So I think that my colleagues would certainly agree that now more than ever, these tenants are needed in our immediate campus and local communities, and certainly more broadly around the state and even nationally. So we do this through interdisciplinary research and collaboration. And this is absolutely vital to our mission for so many reasons. Not the least of all, that looking at issues from a variety of lenses allows the creativity piece of our center to really thrive. So our team at CGRS really embodies this because we're a collection of engineers, biologists, economists, environmental security experts, and humanists, and more. So it's our hope that our efforts will add a little bit of a piece to creating a society that's strong and healthy and secure locally and globally, especially in the face of so many constantly shifting and changing factors, that we've all experienced over the last several months, and inspire others to do the same. And so I would encourage any listener interested to hear more, check us out on Facebook, go to our website and see what we're all about.
I'll know when you've expanded the mission when the name becomes the Center for Universal Resilience and Security.
Yeah.
Why was this a position that you were interested in, Caitlin?
Well, I deeply believe, from a personal perspective, I deeply believe in the power of interdisciplinary study, collaboration, and action. And CGRS is a place where not only is that given lip service, but it's very, very much practiced by every single person involved. And so I saw it as a place where I could bring my own experiences and expertise in languages and cultures and creativity and expression to the table. So in my previous life before coming to Norwich, I worked as an interpreter and a translator for law enforcement and hospitals and public school systems. I was a liaison for migrant education and just did a whole lot of other things, lived and traveled through multiple countries. And so I'm living proof of the value and the power of interdisciplinary approaches. And I really wanted to bring that to CGRS.
I love it. What will your role be at the center?
So I will be the associate director. This academic year, I'm going to be leading efforts for Resilient Vermont, which is one of our six initiatives. I'll be supervising our amazing student fellows who come to us from across the university. There's no one discipline that they come from, but it's really every corner of the school. And I'll be leading the charge on planning our Resilient Vermont conference, which is scheduled for early summer in 2022. And I think one of the projects that I'll also be working on this year that I'm really excited about is coordinating some multilingual stuff for every event that we'll host this year, trying to get resources and information out there in several languages, including ASL, lots of different formats, videos and social media and stuff like that. So it's ambitious for sure, but very exciting.
As a Spanish professor, how had you previously intersected with the center?
Yeah, that's a good question. So last year was my first year on board with the center as a faculty fellow, and I helped to coordinate a hackathon virtual webinar series that we did through our Academic Resilience Collaborative. And specifically, I did one that focused on immigration and border policy in the northern and southern border regions. And then from a language perspective, last year I worked with several of our multilingual students to translate transcripts of our webinars into Spanish, French, and Chinese to share on our social media and our website. And it's actually that project that inspired the idea to really take the multilingual outreach much, much further, really grow it this year and hopefully moving forward as well.
Caitlin, how does having the center at Norwich enhance what the students learn and accomplish in their college years?
Oh, my goodness. So many ways. I think that our student fellows who are involved with the research and the conferences and mentoring and making connections that directly impact the trajectories of their careers would probably be better to ask. But I can certainly say that having CGRS at Norwich means that every single student there has the chance to plug in even an ounce of an interest in a topic into a network that will nurture it and grow it into projects and relationships and fellowship opportunities and more that often become some of the most meaningful experiences of their time at Norwich. Plus, again, it provides an interdisciplinary lens for so many things that when they graduate, this will make students really incredibly marketable and probably, I mean, more importantly, fulfilled when it comes time to plug in their degrees to eventual positions and jobs. I think that coming to college and finding the perfect fit or the perfect major, the perfect track can be incredibly intimidating for so many students. And at CGRS, we try to provide a place that encourages experimenting and exploration. And I think that that can be really just so incredibly important to fostering curiosity and growth academically and personally.
The word resilience is in the center's name. You also mentioned a project, Resilient Vermont. Explain the relevance in the work that's done by the center, the word resilience and how that, again, is kind of manifest in things that are done there.
Yeah, sure. So the human experience and the state of nature are at the core of so much of what CGRS does. So thriving, adapting, evolving, I mean, they're all words that come to mind when I think of the types of programming and projects that we do in each of our initiatives. And resilience, which I think of as the ability to do each of those things, you know, thrive, adapt, and evolve, it's really at the core of that. And I think that there's strength in it. And so including it in the center's name, at least for me, it feels like a type of North Star to frame our mission. And now that I'm so much more involved with brainstorming programming and really making those types of events come to fruition, I find that I constantly reflect on what the word means to me, what it means to the university, to the community, and more broadly to the state.
Caitlin, the center's primary tenets are passion, curiosity, creative thinking, and collaborative problem solving, which really makes sense to me, for college kids, you know, that's really that time of your life when all four of those tenets seem to really be bubbling and going. But tell us how you put them into action at the center.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I agree completely with you. So I'd say that we see the passion component in action with the mentoring that takes place between students and the faculty, organizations, and other community experts that they work so closely with, because they're really dynamic partnerships. And that type of work really elevates our students' involvement. They do things like writing and publishing together, presenting at conferences, and then other things like being out in the field, working to collect data, working with local public school classes, wading in the Dog River, welding in the lab, all of these types of things. I think last year's virtual hackathon webinar series is a great example of putting curiosity into action, since the group of us really put our ear to the ground, if you will, to try and identify what were the questions and issues and challenges most pertinent at that time to Vermonters. So we took that and connected dots between those questions and folks all around the state who were trying to work on solutions or had the insights, and we put it all together for a really interactive experience.
And do you mind explaining,
I'm sorry to interject,
but do you mind explaining, for those who don't know, whenever I hear the term hackathon, my first idea is that you're trying to hack into something, but that's not the case.
Yeah, so basically what the model is, it's bringing people together in our case, in a virtual capacity. We were virtual because of COVID, to not just have a lecture experience, but to have a more of a conversation. So we bring experts to the table and encourage as much audience participation as we possibly can in order to not just present the issues, but actually try to together come up with solutions. And so in that sense, I suppose, you know, there is that idea of hacking away at a problem, doing it together rather than being lectured to, I guess.
All right. That's a great explanation. Now, some of the projects that the center has worked on involved Arctic melting, food security, COVID-19 research, and wastewater testing. Please tie those together for us so we can get an idea of where the center fits into the academic curriculum at Norwich.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's a lot. It's certainly a lot. Many of our academic curricula at Norwich involve real world and often real time application of topics and theories and the like being studied. So of the projects that you just mentioned, climate change, resource shortages, and the pandemic are absolutely real world and real time. And so CGRS being so incredibly hands-on with those topics reflects the more broad mission of the university to be preparing students to make meaningful contributions and solutions to complex and increasingly urgent problems. And so there's a lot of intersection between the curriculum and what we do at the center. And that's on purpose.
Yeah. Is this a different way of approaching what happens in academia today as opposed to having majors in different schools and in different silos?
Well, at Norwich, we do have different schools where different majors and fields are housed. But I suppose blurring the silos is a bit of what we're all about at CGRS by bringing students and faculty from every corner of the university together. I mean, we have students from criminal justice, psychology, international studies, computer science, computer forensics, engineering, nursing, I mean, just everywhere. And so it's just not the world that we live in anymore to be deeply siloed. And so while our students receive an excellent education and training in their chosen field of study, outlets like CGRS allow for a deeper dive into those topics while also injecting components of other fields too. So it's all in that pursuit of well balance.
Yeah, Caitlin, when I went to college, that mix of majors would probably happen on a intramural soccer team and not so much in a center where we all came together. When was the center created?
In 2017.
All right. So still in its infancy, still growing, still kind of directing itself. Are there any examples of graduates, though, who have taken this mission, done something with it after they've left Norwich?
For sure. We've had a student fellow participate in internships at the Cold Regions Engineering Lab in Hanover, New Hampshire, internships at the Woodwell Climate Research Center. Another is currently in a PhD program doing ocean research. And one of our graduates from just this past year is very close to publishing an amazing paper that he's worked on that focuses on the connections between nutrition and radicalization in refugee camps in Burkina Faso. So, and all of these things are continuing in their post Norwich lives.
Nice. Now, I promised that we would also get to know you. We've talked so much about the center, and it's great that you're involved with it. But what classes do you teach at Norwich?
Yeah, sure. So I teach a lot of classes. I teach all levels of Spanish language, so beginner, intermediate, advanced conversation and writing and stuff like that, and as well as a handful of special topics courses, specifically about immigration and the border. I teach a class about comic books and social media, music and politics in Latin America. So really, again, even in my own teaching and my own course design, it's all very interdisciplinary.
It sure is. Now, what is your interest in Spanish in Latin America?
Gosh, that's such a huge question. I was fortunate to start at a very young age. I went to schools that had really strong programs, and I was really fortunate to have teachers that just stoked inspiration and imagination and all those things. And it just became something that was deeply ingrained in my life. And I love it. I absolutely, absolutely love it.
Because you teach this and I think you've been there, do you have any thoughts on what we've seen happening with treatment of migrants at our country's southern border?
I do. I do, certainly. But I think that might be a topic for a whole different show. But for now, I think that what's happening at the southern border is precisely why the presence of a center like CTRS at a university like Norwich, or I mean, really any university for that matter, is so important, because we examine the tough issues using evidence and objectivity. And it's those pursuits that are going to frame how we improve policies and approaches and so much more as a nation moving forward, especially in regards to a country that we have such an interconnected history and border with. So
connect the dots for us. I'm glad you brought that up. You know, what would happen at the center that could help us, could impact us on what's happening there on the southern border?
Well, besides our programming, we have some guest speakers coming to campus that are going to be doing some lecture type, more kind of workshop sessions with students and community members. It's open to the community as well. This spring semester, we're going to be having a workshop on refugees and resettlement, looking at that issue and really framing it within a mental health framework. And also an individual who's involved with a really fantastic project in Vermont, a comic book series for migrant workers, and we're going to be inviting them to campus to talk about how we can illustrate resilience and how art comes into play with resilience.
Wow.
So lots and lots of ways.
Yeah, that is really interesting. Now, there's one more thing. You have so many neat interests, so varied, and so it's been really great to speak with you. But your bio says that you're interested, and I don't understand this, exploring music as a site for resistance.
Yeah.
Please,
sure,
help me with that. This sounds fun to me.
Yeah, sure. So I, as an undergraduate student, I had a professor who opened my eyes to how music can tell us deeply important things about histories and peoples and cultures. And he was a Cuban ethnomusicologist.
Mm.
And so it was really through him that I learned that I could combine creative expression with language and hands-on learning and activism and more. And so I have done a lot of projects looking at how, for example, protest music that was produced and distributed during the Salvadoran Civil War of the 80s impacted the trajectory of the people's side of the movement. So it's looking at music in that way. What do the words tell us? How is it spread? And what are the consequences, positive and negative, but often very positive, of spreading music with really particular messages in them?
A favorite musical artist of yours? Who would that be?
Too many. You don't have enough time in the world for me to list all of those.
All right. We'll let you off the hook there. That's Dr. Caitlin Thomas, a Spanish professor at Norwich University and the new associate director of the school's Center for Global Resilience and Security, CGRS. Yeah, you can learn about the center at norwich.edu. Dr. Thomas, congratulations. Thanks so much for being on the show this morning.
Thank you so much, Rick.
All right, take care. And I'd like to say happy birthday to one of the show's super fans, Cindy from Facetown, who called in this morning and who spotted a number of fishers. So happy birthday, Cindy. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan and produced by Rachel Connor and Brady Jalili. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Please keep those suggestions on topics and guests coming. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. You can also subscribe to the podcast. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.